This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
However you say it, just spell it.
F-E-U-I-L-L-E-T-O-N.
Correct.
Feuilleton, correctly spelled by Ansun Sujo in the final round of last year's Scripps National Spelling Bee, making Ansun and his opponent, Sriram Hathwar, co-champions. The first time that title's been shared since 1962. This year, more than 10 million students between the ages of 6 and 14 compete in the run-up to the Big B. Over the past three decades, more than half of the winners have been Indian American. And an Indian American has taken the trophy every year since 2007. Those public wins fuel a stereotype of Indian American students as dutiful and disciplined, a model minority. Shalini Shankar is an associate professor of anthropology and Asian American studies at Northwestern University. She wrote about this prevailing belief in an article for Pacific Standard called How Do You Spell Stereotype? And Shalini, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me, Virginia.
So this idea of Indian American students as terrific spellers is part of a long-standing stereotype. Stereotypes aside, why do you think this demographic keeps finding its way to the winner's circle?
It's an interesting question. It's a very recent phenomenon. If you look at it over the history of the spelling bee, which, the National Spelling Bee started in 1925. So it's very recent that we see Indian American students dominating as they have. But I think it's because they've really figured out a few secrets about how to crack the spelling bee code, and they've been really diligent about applying themselves to actually accomplish that.
And part of the cracking of the code you mention is that many of the contestants are involved in what you call the minor league spelling bee circuit. How does that play into it?
That's right. So there are two different circuits, at least. In some regional areas, there are even more. But there are these spelling bees that are targeted toward children of South Asian parentage. One is through a nonprofit foundation called the North South Foundation, and the other is through a commercial venture called the South Asian Spelling Bee, which is sponsored by MetLife. And between these two circuits, children of South Asian parentage are invited to participate in regional bees held in up to 14, 16 different metro areas in the United States. And then if they advance in those, they get to compete in national competitions for those two bees. And this is in addition to all of the exposure that they get through the National Spelling Bee Circuit. So they just have far more practice and far more opportunities to hone their craft.
How about the kind of particular culture of Indian Americans that might make them great spellers?
I think there are a few things that contribute to that, but it's also worth noting that this is a very small subsection, even of the Indian American population. This is a population that, in general, has valued science and technology and engineering far more than the language arts. So it is a bit of a peculiar thing that we're seeing this phenomenon happening. But in any event, some of the things that contribute to it are that many of these children come from homes in which parents are fluent in English. There are kind of social opportunities in which parents share ideas of how to help their children and coach them for spelling bees. It's actually a very complicated thing to prepare for a spelling bee at the level at which you could win a national championship. Mm-hmm. And so sharing some of that knowledge is actually a key part of how these kids get a head start in the process.
Well, let's get to your point about the looking at spelling bee stars as the quote-unquote model minorities. This is a term that's been kicking around for a few decades. But like all stereotypes, a woefully inadequate simplifications. So what does that miss?
I think one of the things it misses is the sheer amount of labor and effort and sacrifice that some of these students put into preparing for the spelling bee. So the model minority stereotype suggests that there's just something sort of inherent or almost genetic, so to speak, about this type of success and that it comes very easy. And what is worth noting is that these students spend an inordinate amount of their childhoods trying to prepare for and compete in this. And for every winner that you see, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of other students who have spent that kind of time who aren't actually getting this sort of recognition and accolade. So I think it takes a toll on childhood in ways that we don't really see readily when we just celebrate a model minority as being an unqualified success.
What is it projecting upon Indian Americans?
I think it's projecting upon them some sort of privileged success, and that success is only in contrast to other minorities who have not succeeded in analogous ways. I think that most of the time, currently, model minorities tend to be juxtaposed to African Americans, to Latinos, perhaps Native Americans, as being this group that unequivocally succeeds in realms such as education, in business, and in society in general. But what we actually see is that there's such great variance even among Asian American populations that often it's the way that people write about them that makes them seem model and that reduces those sorts of differences and also creates these very pernicious comparisons to other racial groups. Mm-hmm. It's important to note that Asian Americans themselves are not always, if ever, the ones who are promoting this vision of their own accomplishment.
Hmm. What comes with that stereotype? What kinds of backlashes against Indian Americans?
I think the ones that have been well documented are around college admissions. We see backlash of quotas being set where only a certain numbers of Asian Americans are permitted, even if their other qualifications are above students of other groups. We see this in workplaces with the quote-unquote bamboo ceiling, where certain types of upper management promotion or, advancing into certain realms of upper management is very difficult for Asian Americans to accomplish. But I think it's also important to think about the fact that a lot of the things that people project onto Asian Americans as model minorities are just that, they're projections. I think that they are a group that are plagued with very much the similar set of issues that other groups are plagued with. And also, there in all of these other racial and ethnic groups, you see tremendous success as well that doesn't get reported under this one heading. So it's just simplifying a very complicated picture of life in the United States today.
Shalini, the Scripps National Spelling Bee is coming up in May, and I just wonder if part of you as a scholar looking at this is a little apprehensive, you know, ready to hear it all again, that Indian Americans always win these things, not quote-unquote real Americans. They're taking over that kind of thinking.
I think that we do stand to experience that sort of social media response, but it does have to be taken into account that for so many years, most of the winners of the National Spelling Bee were white Americans. And so nobody thought to remark that that was odd, right? So we only notice this as a streak because it's a non-white group that has moved into a space where it was previously a white contest. And I think that that is always going to be unsettling, but to their credit, the National Spelling Bee is very even-handed about managing how spellers are treated, and it is really a minority voice in social media that creates these racist responses to the spelling bee. So hopefully there'll be enough counter response to it to keep it quiet or keep it in its place.
Shalini Shankar, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Shalini Shankar is Associate Professor of Anthropology and Asian American Studies at Northwestern University and author of the new book, Advertising Diversity, Ad Agencies and the Creation of Asian American Consumers. She wrote the article, How Do You Spell Stereotype for Pacific Standard? We do have a link to the article and more on her book at wordofmouthradio.org. Labeling others invites generalizations and stereotypes, but are essential in other contexts. Up next, a farmer grapples with how to label his livestock. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Organic, locally grown, certified humane, ethical, cage-free. Farmers are all too familiar with the finer points of labeling their products. But what really makes a humane farmer humane? Can one really quantify ethical in the context of food production? Shizue Rochadichi headed out to Morris, Connecticut to talk with a farmer who's foregoing the labels and relying on a story to win over customers.
My name is Tom Truelove, and I am a farmer. The name of my farm is Truelove Farms, and our operation is a small, diversified, pasture-based farm. So we raise pasture-raised pork, grass-fed beef, eggs on pasture, and meat chickens as well.
On a Saturday afternoon, I drove up from New Haven to Morris, Connecticut, to Truelove Farms, where Tom and his girlfriend Lindsay showed me around.
You guys are, they were born in the beginning of December, so what does that make them? 4 months old?
A lot of animals on the farm don't have names for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But the boars do. The older one is Mao, the red pig.
As in Mao. The farm looks pretty idyllic, perched just off the country highway. Rolling hills and expansive fields give way to forest, and chickens roam freely around the old red barn, playing tag, it seems, with the surprisingly agile hogs. But this image of the perfect farm can be misleading. Don't get me wrong, Tom's farm is pretty incredible, but no one's perfect.
Obviously, in your mind, you sort of see one thing, and you know what you would like the farm to be, but, the most immediate hurdle is money. You know, a farm is... turns out, after all, to be a business like anything else. And so, sort of trying to break myself of the vision of what I wanted to be, you know, I knew I desperately wanted to raise all the animals outside on pasture, and animal welfare was a really important factor. But it quickly became apparent that I wasn't going to be organic certified just because of where I was, the lack of organic slaughterhouses, and the cost.
Too often the conversation surrounding sustainable agriculture is reduced to a simple question of morals and ideals. This romanticized vision of what it means to be a so-called good farmer leaves little room for compromise. But farming sustainably isn't so black and white. Tom knows this firsthand. When he started Truelove Farms 5 years ago, he wanted to fit that ideal. But he quickly learned that to make a real go of it, he'd have to resign himself to what was realistic.
If you try to do everything in a perfect way, you'll just fail. Like when I started to price out organic feed, which is really the biggest impediment to not being certified, it just quickly became apparent that if I wanted to ever sell anything to any of my neighbors, I would have to just feed conventional feed, at least for the time being. So it was all about finding that middle ground, finding what worked for us as a farm, but at the same time, it's not everything I immediately had hoped for.
Farms like Truelove Farms, those that forgo the labels and the certification, find it hard to communicate their practices to the public. As consumers, we're taught to rely on labels. But when large corporations can co-opt these terms, do the labels retain any meaning?
the vocabulary of agriculture is so laden. I mean, just to take one example, eggs. You know, you can have your industrial eggs. Are your eggs cage-free? Are your eggs pasture-raised? Are they free-range? Are they organic? And all these things are not necessarily overlapping. So to try to explain to people what choices you've made versus what they have in their head, it's tough. I guess if I was going to describe myself, I am a self-cynical farmer. You know, the farm is, we're doing the best we can.
So what do we call these farms that don't subscribe to the neat and tidy ideals of our farm utopia? Tom's farm isn't certified organic, but it's not exactly conventional either.
I mean, our sort of tagline is natural, ethical, and sustainable. But it's, even those words are rendered almost meaningless when you really start to unpack them. You know, like ethical, like yes, we raise our animals to the best of our ability and we try to give them happy lives. But, you know, another person could argue that raising livestock, period, is unethical. You know, natural is a word that a lot of people have said has become almost meaningless because it's put on corporate labels. But what other word can I use to describe the fact that we're raising pigs in a habitat as closely mirroring their natural evolutionary origins as possible? You know, and then sustainability, sustainable is obviously a tricky question. You know, if I had the perfect farm where I was feeding organic, non-GMO, non-corn, non-soy grain to my chickens and everything was ideal, that'd be wonderful. But I honestly don't think I could make a living that way. You know, people do ask, are you organic? And I have to tell them, no, but we're X, Y, and Z. You know, it's a difficult middle ground. In a lot of ways, it'd be easier to just say, yes, we do everything perfectly, you know, to the nth degree. But that's not feasible either.
So tell me, how do your pigs grow?
Yeah, the pigs grow well. I'm trying to get to a point where we're breeding and raising all our pigs on farm. I still buy in some, but the ones we primarily breed are all heritage hybrid.
What do they eat?
They get a corn soy ration in addition to whatever they can forage, you know. And then
so you
during
grow the corn and the soy?
I don't, no.
You don't.
I mean, we're on 100 acres, so right. We're a little bit limited in size. Okay. You fall into this middle ground where, you know, you just hope to be honest with people and hope that your vision and values line up with enough of the customers. Believe me, if the price of organic GMO-free grain came down to a point, and I'm not saying even a point on parity with what I'm paying now, but a point that was within grasp, I would go that way in a heartbeat. But I'm struggling as it is to make a go of it, right, you know, with what I'm doing. So I've got to pick my fights, and that's not a fight I'm ready to pick right now. I know that, you know, my eggs are already expensive compared to what people can find at the supermarket and what they can, you know, find in other places. And so if they went up in price, perhaps I could sell to the New York set or people down in, you know, on the Gold Coast, but my neighbors wouldn't buy my stuff, and I wouldn't be a community farm. Hey, how's it going, man?
Hi, how's it going?
Very well.
Good. I want to get 3 of the eggs, please.
You got it. All right. 15, please.
Eggs?
You like eggs. Most of these go into your body.
good.
She loves them every day.
All right,
thank
enjoy.
You. See you next week.
See you later. If the person up the road can come to me for their bacon or their hamburger, you know, that's important. That the people who live around me buy from me. That it's not just a matter of tourists from New York State, or that it's not just me taking my products to markets elsewhere. So it's been about finding my niche, you know, finding what works for us as a farm.
So maybe farming on the blurred line is striving for perfection in context. By rejecting labels as absolute markers of value, we might achieve a more inclusive definition of sustainability, one that recognizes the importance of community integration and financial viability.
I definitely think we're closer to sort of this new idea of hopefully sustainable agriculture, and if you want to go there, organic agriculture, than we are conventional. But, you know, one of the things that's become readily apparent is that everybody's different. Every farm is different, and labels rapidly fall apart, you know, because you've got to stop looking for templates and roadmaps, and you've got to just keep looking for inspiration. You know, what's going to get you up in the morning? Everyone has to learn that for themselves. I bristle at the idea of any certification, whether it's organic certification or animal welfare certification. You know, I like to think in a perfect world that my word is good enough, you know, and also being able to show people. I know that that's not the case, and a stamp really helps, but, you know, when industrial organic certification is rendered so meaningless, and so many of these certifications are, I don't know. I'd like to get to the point where people just know their farmer and trust their farmer, which is probably a little naive, but let's hope for it.
Maybe we can't all know our farmers, but perhaps we can be more wary of the reductive conversations surrounding sustainable food and agriculture. We can begin to question the labels affixed to our shrink-wrapped steaks, and when shopping at farmers market, we can learn to ask, what are your growing practices? Instead of just, are you organic? Because when it comes to sustainable food, context means everything. True value isn't found in a string of adjectives. It's found in a story.
And that story was brought to us by Shizue Rochadichi. Up next, we'll deconstruct another contentious label, electrohypersensitivity. While the medical community does not recognize it as a real disorder, a growing number of people in our wireless world claim to suffer from it and are seeking refuge in a small West Virginia town. We'll find out more after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Upon entering Green Bank, West Virginia, a pastoral town home to less than 150 residents, your cell phone signal goes dead, your radio goes silent, and it is almost impossible to find Wi-Fi. You have now entered the National Radio Quiet Zone. While Green Bank would not be ideal for the tech-savvy, it is becoming a refuge for people who identify as having electrohypersensitivity, or EHS, characterized by an array of symptoms from headaches to hair loss caused by exposure to electromagnetic waves. Steve Featherstone is a writer and photographer from upstate New York, and he made the journey to Green Bank, where local skeptics are living alongside refugees from the electromagnetic age. He wrote about it for Popular Science. Steve, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So describe this small town of Green Bank, West Virginia, for us.
Well, first of all, it's a beautiful little town. You come in off a ridge in the Allegheny Mountains, which is just in the middle of the, I think it's the Monongahela National Forest. And you come off the ridge into town, and it kind of opens up into this beautiful valley. And the first thing you see is this enormous radio telescope. And when I say telescope, it's not an optical telescope. It's like a big, what looks like a big radar dish. In the town itself, there's just a public school, a few shops, a gas station, and a post office.
What's this is the Green Bank telescope that you just mentioned. It's the largest steerable radio telescope in the world, which is so strange because this is a place where people go to escape from radio signals and towers and cell phones. Why here? Why this telescope?
Well, that's a really good point because it seems kind of contradictory. You've got this enormous radio telescope in the middle of what's called the National Radio Quiet Zone. And this is a big chunk of land that takes up the eastern part of West Virginia and the northern part of the state of Virginia and maybe a tiny slice of Maryland. And it was set aside in 1958 by the federal government so that this big telescope could listen to the cosmos without any interference. The site manager put it to me this way. He said, it's so sensitive, it can pick up on radio signals that give off the equivalent energy of a snowflake hitting the ground.
Wow.
Yeah, so you can imagine, because it's so sensitive, you have to regulate any kind of radio transmission within 13,000 square miles of this particular dish.
Wow.
So there are no cell towers, there are no TV broadcast towers, There's no radio transmitters.
So that is what the draw is for people who say that they suffer from electrohypersensitivity. Now, first, what is that?
It's funny because EHS really isn't a medical condition as far as the medical establishment is concerned. It's sort of it's a self-described condition. And the people who come down with it kind of arrive at the conclusion that what's causing their aches and pains or their hair loss or their rashes or their heart palpitations or whatever the sort of condition that they're ailing from is from a cell phone tower, a cell phone that their neighbor has. And that's what they are sort of these folks who have EHS are saying are causing the problems.
You met several people who suffer from this and who made their way to Green Bank and some who are just sort of trying it out. One of the women you interviewed said that she feels like she's being cooked to death every time she's near electromagnetic radiation. Another that bolts of pain shoot through her when she's near a cell phone. Now, some estimate that 10 million people suffer from it. So why do most doctors deny its existence?
Because there's really no link that's been found in any kind of scientific matter between electromagnetic signals and effects on the body.
Yet the country of Sweden recognizes EHS as a functional impairment, and the WHO, World Health Organization, actually classified RF radiation as a possible carcinogenic. I'm just wondering if there's any real research on whether or not it can harm the body.
Well, there is research. There's lots of research. If you can think of radiation in two ways, you've got let's just call it bad radiation. This is the stuff that we know causes cancer, and that's nuclear radiation, okay? We call that kind of radiation kind of goes into your body, and it strips electrons off of atoms, and it causes havoc inside your cells. Now, electromagnetic radiation is just below that threshold, and so it's been thought, and it is still thought, that electromagnetic radiation is neutral. It does not do anything to the cells in your body, except for one thing, and that's it heats them up. It heats up the fluid inside the cells.
And so like microwaving your cells?
Exactly. So that's the only recognized side effect of electromagnetic radiation.
Well, that doesn't sound good, Steve.
No. But there are other studies ongoing now. So the WHO study you mentioned, that classified electromagnetic radiation specifically from cell phones as a class 2B carcinogen. Mind you, class 2B carcinogens also include coffee. So, it's not a declaration that this will cause cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a way for the WHO to say we should keep an eye on this.
Well, I'm thinking that this is like cigarettes in the 20th century. We're going to find out, 40 years from now that all this charged atmosphere, cell phone signals, Wi-Fi signals are causing irrevocable harm.
Yeah, it's funny because I know all the EHS sufferers I spoke to, they compare the wireless industry to the tobacco industry.
Mm-hmm.
They believe the wireless industry trying to cover things up. Many believe that the government is in, cahoots with the wireless industry in sort of keeping the science under wraps or maybe not funding the science that would eventually lead to a connection between electromagnetic radiation exposure and, diseases. So they do. They sincerely believe that there's a kind of a conspiracy out there that resembles the tobacco industry of the mid-century.
I'm reading about this people that you meet, this woman, Diane Hsu. She and her husband left their Iowa farm. Another woman, Jennifer, left Hawaii because she was losing weight, couldn't understand why. They don't sound like, they're wearing tin hats because they're afraid of electromagnetic rays reaching them. I mean, what was your sense of those who sought refuge in Green Bank?
Well, that's a good point because before I left to go there, that's exactly what I expected, the tinfoil hat crowd. And that's not what I found at all. Diane Scow, in particular, Diane has a PhD. These aren't folks who are just hiding in their basement. They're out there. They're very familiar with technology. They use technology every day. Jennifer, an accomplished architect. The other two women I met there were both commercial airline pilots. heavy users of technology and, you know, people who aren't just going to look at technology as something that they need to run away from. I mean, they need it for their jobs. So they didn't come to Green Bank willingly. They all had stories that that sort of put them more in the line of, like, refugees. They felt like refugees, I guess, mm-hmm. and that they kind of fled to Green Bank.
Steve Featherstone is with us. He's a writer and photographer who visited Green Bank, West Virginia. That's a town that's become a kind of refuge for people who say that they suffer from electrohypersensitivity, or EHS. Well, now they're in this town, no cell phones, no television, no radio. Are residents of Green Bank cut off from the outside world?
Not really. They're not cut off so much because, you know, you can use, they can have satellite TV, you know, dish TV. They can have cable. The one thing they can't have, at least within 10 miles of the dish, is Wi-Fi or even a cordless phone, microwave ovens, you know, iPads, all that stuff. So they're not exactly cut off, but all the things that we take for granted today for entertainment and communication are very, very strictly regulated there.
How have the residents of this town with a population of 143 responded to dozens of new neighbors settling in, most of them in an old motel in one-room shacks at the edge of town?
Yeah, that's funny because, you know, I never came to a definite number on how many folks with EHS are living in the town. It was really unclear to me. I met maybe a dozen myself. And I heard stories about people with EHS who came into town, tried to live there, and just gave up and left. And some of the reasons why they gave up is because they were coming from, you know, urban areas like Los Angeles or New York. And they tried to make a go of it in Green Bank. They're like, look, whatever my problem is, I can't take living here. And they would move. The people who stay, though, I think they get along quite well with the sort of natural-born residents of Green Bank.
So some of whom are skeptics of this.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing that really struck me. And I think if when you say they're skeptical not of the science. They're not out there reading the scientific literature and coming up with a conclusion based on the literature. Everything, and especially in a small town, in any small town anywhere, everything comes down to personal relationships.
Hmm.
So if Diane, who is sort of the patron saint of electro-hypersensitive folks in Green Bank, her personality might rub some people the wrong way in a small town like that. So no matter what the evidence might say, they're just not going to believe her because they don't like her. There are other people who get along quite well with the residents of Green Bank and have a great relationship with them. There's one guy I met, Arnie Stewart. Arnie is a volunteer at the local library. The library itself is kind of a little haven in Green Bank because it has the only computers connected to the internet by cable, of course, not wireless. And people come into the library all the time, myself included. When I was there, I kind of found myself there like 3 times a day doing email. Arnie sincerely believes that EHS is a real thing, but he'll say, well, I don't think this person really has it because I saw them using some kind of device, and I can't believe it's real.
Small towns anywhere.
Exactly.
Huh?
That's right. Exactly.
Well, is it hard now to move into Green Bank? I mean, are they opening their doors for this?
I think they are. I mean, there's no one there that would be averse to someone moving into town. It's just really difficult. It's not a place where there's, like, real estate listings readily available. So it's really hard to find places to live and work and even shop. There's a Dollar General store in town, but a lot of the EHS folks find difficulty going in there because, I mean, it's got like one of those electric doors, right, that kind of open up automatically.
Wow.
And that, you know, that kind of causes a problem.
Fluorescent lights.
The fluorescent lights. So the store itself has gotten so used to electrosensitive folks, needing things that the clerks will actually bring items out to the sidewalk and let them pay for them outside in the parking lot, kind of like a valet service at the dollar store.
Well, Steve, I'm wondering, we have to wrap, but I'm wondering, after reporting on this story and visiting Green Bank, were you convinced of the existence of EHS?
You know, yes, for these people I was. I remain convinced that they believe that they have this condition and that electromagnetic, radiation is causing it. Now, it might be psychosomatic, but it's real. I mean, they really feel it. I mean, they're not faking it. No one would, I think, choose the life that they're choosing. It's not easy. I myself, after looking at the scientific literature, talking to scientists, I made a few small changes. I took the wireless router out of my office. It was like literally sitting right next to my leg. And I thought, does it really need to be that close? Mm-hmm. So I took it out. I put it in the basement. Still got the same good signal, but it's not right next to my body. You know, I don't leave my cell phone on in my pocket like I used to. I'll turn it off. So I made a few small changes. I don't know if it's made any difference, but it can't hurt.
Well, Steve Featherstone, you've convinced me. Steve Featherstone is a writer and photographer from upstate New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Steve wrote about a refuge from electrohypersensitivity in West Virginia for Popular Science magazine. Now you can find his article and learn more about Green Bank at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, an event that we don't expect to appeal to electro-hypersensitives, but film buffs will certainly be interested in hearing more about the Monadnock International Film Festival. It's kicking off in Keene tonight. More on that in just a minute when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Monadnock International Film Festival kicks off today in Keene and runs through the weekend. It's an opportunity for filmmakers and film lovers to rub shoulders in an intimate small-town setting. This year's program offers some terrific feature-length and short films made by big-name directors and producers, as well as locals. Lena Barakat is executive director of MONIF. And Lena, great to have you back with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So you've got this opening party today, red carpet party, and a film tonight, Little Boy. What can you tell us about it?
It's a great film. It stars Kevin James and David Henry. It's a movie that really discusses the power of a little boy's love for his father and how children, you know, they can hope beyond belief to the point where this child believes that if he wishes it hard enough, he can bring his father home from the war. And the movie actually kind of goes there a little bit. And it's a really heartwarming, fun way to open our film festival this year.
And that's World War II?
Absolutely.
Okay. The Good Lie, another highlight on Saturday night.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about this?
That is a powerful film. It's our Jonathan Daniels award-winning film, which is an award we give to filmmakers whose work is both artistically excellent and socially conscious. It's a movie that the screenwriter Margaret Nagel, who will be there with us, she worked for 10 years to make this movie happen because she really believed in it. Back in 1983, there was a civil war in Sudan, and afterwards it left thousands of children orphaned, and they were known as the Lost Boys of Sudan. And these boys traveled as much as 1,000 miles on foot just to try to find safety. So 15 years later, there was an initiative to try to bring a lot of those boys, not so young anymore, some of them, over to the States and try to help them, you know, find safety and a home. And the film stars Reese Witherspoon, who just, you know, came off of an Oscar award nomination. And the movie stars actual Sudanese actors who were children of the war. So it's a really powerful film. Their portrayals are really excellent. And as always, our Jonathan Daniels Award evening usually leaves people in tears.
All right, so let's hear just a little clip from The Good Lie.
It's my fault. It's all my fault.
What's your fault?
I let my brother be taken away by soldiers instead of me to protect us, to protect me.
So those are two of the big highlight films, but there's stuff going on all weekend. Mm-hmm. I have to say one of my favorite parts of the program, the shorts. That's on Saturday?
Yes. And our short program was so popular last year, we actually added a second one. So on Saturday, there are two shorts programs. They feature both documentary shorts, narrative shorts, anything from, you know, films made in America to across the world, just like last year. And I'm really, really excited about them this year again.
There's a big focus for the Monadnock Film Festival on local programming. What is this Think Local thing I keep seeing pop up on the schedule?
Yeah, Think Local is a way for us to give a voice to New Hampshire filmmakers. So it showcases both narrative and documentary shorts and features. There are films that were made either in the state of New Hampshire by New Hampshire filmmakers about New Hampshire topics. And this year, we are really lucky in our submissions. We actually got two feature films that were excellent. So not only do you have a shorts program block, which is everything from a documentary about local brewing in the state of New Hampshire to a really powerful piece about AIDS to our student award-winning piece. It's really cool stop motion about a blob. It's really kind of great. But then we have these two feature films, which are really exciting to be able to have something that's that good quality coming out of New Hampshire.
What are the films?
One of them is called Anchor's Children. It's a Cambodian documentary. The producer is from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Carlina Lyons. And she's gone over there a lot for different jobs. And this is a feature she shot over there. And it's really fantastic. We also have a film called The Next Great American Game, which I personally am really excited about. Our graphic designer, Randall Hoyt, is from New Hampshire here, lives here, and teaches at Keene State College. And in his spare time, he designed this board game, which I've played multiple times. It's actually a lot of fun. And this is a documentary that follows him as he's trying to get his game sold. So he's going to Comic-Con and he's going to all the game conferences and he doesn't know what he's doing in these places or what he's talking about, but he really wants to win and he wants to get his game sold. He also is grappling and struggling with being bipolar and he explores that a lot through the process and it's a really vulnerable personal piece about an artist kind of going out there and giving something a try that's maybe a little bit outside of his wheelhouse, but it's funny and entertaining and he's charming and I love it. And so he'll be here to talk about it afterwards.
What's the name of that film?
The Next Great American Game.
The Next Great American Game. We're going through the program for the Monadnock International Film Festival kicking off today in Keene, running through the entire weekend. I was there last year. I moderated a panel and had, I must say, a really, really great time. But one of the things that really impressed me is that there are a lot of filmmakers and a lot of people who just love films. Who do you have on these panels this year that might be interesting to both crowds?
Absolutely. So one of our panels this year is about short filmmaking, which I think is going to be really good because in New Hampshire in particular, we make a lot of short films, far more than the amount of feature films. I don't know what the reason is, you know, making a good
economic,
short...
Economic, I suppose, probably. Is a big part of it. It's
absolutely
a hard thing.
Yeah, and the time commitment. You know, but making a good short film, it's not like it's just, oh, well, you couldn't make a feature. You know, being able to write and produce a good short film is an art in and of itself. And this panel is going to be really interesting. And we have a mix of both local and non-local filmmakers on it. We have filmmaker Matt Harder, who did a great short film that's in our block. I think his is in the second block. We also have Jeff Stern. His piece is in the second film block as well. We have Kyle Gilman, who not only produced a short film in the program, but he also edited Ned Rifle, which is one of our feature films this year. So it's nice. He's got a feature, he's got a short, and he's on a panel. He's sort of a Renaissance man of Monif. And then we've got two local filmmakers. One, Kyle Turgeon. He's from New Hampshire, grew up here, has moved to Nashville since, but made this great little piece about a bipolar musician. It's a documentary short, so he'll be on the panel. And then Toni Nagy, who used to write for, she still writes for Huffington Post, a variety of other publications. She has developed pilots for MTV, lives in Dublin, New Hampshire, and has made multiple short films, has one of them in the Think Local block, and will be on the panel.
Well, let's hear just a little clip from anybody out there.
Something's wrong. It was working back at the house. You saw it, right?
I think so. I mean, the light was on and...
Exactly. The light was on and the motor was spinning. Everything was perfect. This has to work!
And again, to clarify, the shorts program will be on Saturday at 11 o'clock, and then there will be a second program at 4 o'clock. And that reminds me, Lena, a logistical question. I mean, can people just drop in on these films, or do they have to get a whole weekend pass?
So, yeah, you can go to any individual film. It's $12.50. You get those tickets right at the theaters that they're playing. So if it's at Keene State, get them there. If it's at the Colonial Theater, you get them there. If you want to save money, you're planning on going to a few films, the film pass is really worth it. It's $60. It gets you into every movie and both panels. And if you really want to have the filmmaker experience and, you know, be treated like you're on the red carpet, I'd go for the VIP pass. It's $95. It gets you into every movie, every panel. It gets you special early admission to get better seats, a swag bag full of really cool swag, free booze in the filmmaker lounge. I mean, it can't get better than that.
Lena Barakat, doing it big at the Monadnock International Film Festival. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
She's the executive director, by the way, of MONIF, and it's kicking off today in Keene, running through the entire weekend. Now, there's a link to a lot more details and schedule online at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, and that's where you can subscribe to our podcast. You can also find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you like the podcast, pass it along, word of mouth style. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.